Welcome. My name is Christian Corley, and I am joined by Brian Turnover and James McLean. Happy New Year to you, dear listener. It is the Casterbridge Podcast with the... I don't know what it's called anymore. It is the Casterbridge Podcast with a K. In its... Guys, in its third decade.
As far as intros go, I think you nailed it.
I can't. It's like me and Brian sat down one day in 2007 and recorded some bollocks, which Brian then edited on a GarageBand and put some fart sounds in, and we're still doing it, only without fart sounds. Happy 2020, dear listener. You've obviously tuned in, not to listen to me cackle inanely at the stupidity of the fact that our podcast has been going so long. But feel free to join in. But also, we're going to talk about Doctor Who Series 12, mostly Episode 2, because no doubt we'll end up talking about aspects of Episode 1 as well. It's Spyfall Part 2, which aired last night on Sunday, the 5th of January. We're going to have to just do a quick brief thing about how we found the first episode. And we're going to keep it brief because we're going to expand on the second episode. It's a bit new. It's a bit different from the last run. So, first off, James, how did it strike you?
The first episode?
Yeah.
I thought it was good. I thought... I didn't feel it was massively different to last year, but I could feel that there was agency in sort of bringing it back to sort of like a Davis-era feel. Mm-hmm. There were issues with it, which I think we'll probably talk about, because I think there's still issues of character development and how they deal with... the quartet, which are probably its weakest areas. I think the movement sort of homaged the spy genre, and James Bond was perhaps a little too much for the episode to carry occasionally, like the cycle chase fell a bit stretched and a little under par, perhaps a little too much for what they could really do. But there was some lovely cinematography, lots of different locations, lots of positive vibes, great twist at the end. Which I wasn't expecting. It was good. I think overall it was very good.
Yeah. Brian, episode one, quick thoughts.
I pretty much would just kind of echo what James said there, with the exception that I did get the twist at the end, they made a big deal about the Doctor knowing O and meeting him before. And I'm like, we never met this guy before. And I'm like, they're probably going to tell us how they met, and they never did. And then all of a sudden he had that incredible space gate that was able to stop aliens from coming into his cabin, but the Doctor couldn't stop them from coming into the TARDIS. So I'm like, something's going on here. What's up with this guy? He's not who he says he is. And then I kind of clocked what was going on. But aside from that, it was a good start. Little bit over the top in some areas, but if we're comparing it to other eras, it was fine.
You're running though from the fact that you are one of these nerds who's been doing podcasts for 3 decades. And I thought we'd met him before. So I was kind of fooled by that. And of course, I was getting confused with the fact that he was doing Waris Hussein in Adventures of Time and Space. And so I sort of clocked him in my head that he had been a bit character in one of the Davis era. And I'd forgotten about it. So that threw me right off. And that also played into the fact that he knew the Doctor when he was a different gender. So they were a different gender. So I was, by my own hoist by my own petard or whatever, I was totally thrown. And I imagine a lot of audiences were thrown on that basis. So they would have assumed that had happened before and they'd not forgotten, or they didn't watch it so closely as you nerds, and weren't so clued in to clock that. So I was happily...
I'm saying to you, James. I thought he'd been in it, and also because he's Sacha Dhawan's quite obviously he's been in TV shows in the US now, hasn't he? But he works a lot in the UK as well, so you're going to run into him, and there's no reason why a casual viewer is not going to watch that and think, oh yeah, he's been Doctor Who before, because he's a familiar face on TV over the past 10 years.
No, absolutely. So I was unlike Terror Nerdo. I didn't get that, but it's a shame that your knowledge kind of spoilt their twist, because it was really nice to have that moment And just, you know, as soon as he says, you know, the spy master, actually, no, I think it's when he said, oh, somehow my brain was going, okay, I think I can see where this is going. Didn't you get, oh, this is feeling familiar territory here. The territory of the master reveal, which sometimes has been great in the past, like in the final Capaldi two-parter, or maybe in, some people might argue for Castrovalva, which I think we did in one of the podcast commentaries. Sometimes it hasn't been so good, like with Time Flight, where, you know, it's kind of obvious who he is. But it's nice to have that sort of traditional approach and for it to work for most people, unlike those of us who are tuned in and a little more attuned to where the show is going.
But I wouldn't say that it ruined it for me, because for me, it's all part of figuring out the plot. Whenever I watch movies and TV shows, it's trying to figure out where are they going with this, what's actually going on. And that's why I was able to kind of like pick up on that. I'll put it to you this way. If they didn't have his house have all of these magical tools to stop these aliens that the doctor knew nothing about and could get inside her TARDIS, I probably would have just sat there and went, at some point, they're going to tell us the adventure that these two had before, and it's probably going to connect. But instead, I was like, this is too much. This is just too much. And I kind of started to see that it wasn't going exactly where it should go. And then when, you know, right when they were on the plane and she said the whole thing about the sprinting and the look on her face, I'm like, okay, he's definitely not who he says he is. And I started to kind of like piece it together there.
So it's a bit sixth sensey, isn't it? That if you clock on early for whatever reason, you see it in a sort of slightly different way. Doesn't mean it's less enjoyable, but you're going down a different path with it and assessing it in a different. Because for me, my pathway, because I think this was intentional, because they'd placed him as a Bond-like spy in a spy world, the sort of energy field around the TARDIS, effectively, that used to block off the creatures, to me was almost like, oh, this is just another one of their Torchwoodian sort of spy-like equipment that they're using. It didn't clock to me that was like advanced technology with the hexagons as well, which could sort of have a TARDIS link to it if you're going down your route, saying that this is not quite right here. Something's not quite going. This is so. To me, he was a protagonist all the way through until, as you say, he gets on the plane and she's alerted by that. And suddenly you're thinking, okay, what's going on here? Then where's the twist?
And I think if they didn't get in the TARDIS, I probably would have thought, okay, this is just some alien tech that was recovered that he brought with him. But it just didn't gel that they would have something that was better than what the doctor had.
Okay, so that's episode one, which I was quite amused to hear that the voice of the Kasavin was the face of Bo as well.
Oh,
was it? See, I was curious about that. I didn't look at that because I thought it might have been Sasha himself because of the way that he laughed. That was spoiled when I saw part two and realized, okay, these are definitely some kind of alien creatures, which is. Mainly what I assumed anyway, that the master was working with somebody. But when they laughed at the doctor at the one point, I was like, oh man, this is him playing with them.
They're good as well. Should worth saying that I thought their visual and audio as well, the oral effects were really powerful as in that first part. It was not really used in the second part, but their presentation and their sort of introduction was really strong as well in terms of creating something new.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. Now, the first episode was directed by Jamie Magnus Stone. The second episode was directed by Lee Haven Jones. So it's interesting that they've got a two-part episode with different directors. And it has kind of followed that pattern of the majority of Doctor Who two-parts since 2005 in that it takes a different turn. Now, this is the interesting part about part two, I think, perhaps. And, well, I mean, the guys might disagree with me. But it kind of takes steps that aren't out of step with series 11, yet manage and I'm talking mainly about Ada Lovelace and Noor Inayat Khan, but it doesn't feel as if they've been placed there or the visit is there for a purpose of educating. They feel like they've got a part to play in the story throughout, and I think that feels like there's a bit more confidence about what the show's doing this time around.
I was locked in a different part when you were saying that, like, the story took a different turn, because everything was working well in part one for me. But in part two, when the companions survived the plane crash because the doctor solved everything after saving the day, I was like, I don't like that so much.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would have preferred that there was another way out of that situation. Because right there, that, I mean, you know, the doctor's going to win. It's a Doctor Who episode. You know, the doctor's going to win. But it would have been much better if there was a better way out of that situation. But yeah, traveling to the different times and having the different characters, it worked, because it was nice to see the doctor, like, stuck in a situation where she can't help her friends. But having seen that she already did help her friends, it took away from that fact for me. You know, to see them truly be cut off from the doctor and on the run, having to try and save the day without her while she's trying to get back there just to try and help them and save the day. That's a great idea. But it was ruined by the fact that she had already saved her friends. So that's one of two things in this story for sure that I definitely didn't care for.
Maybe it would have been interesting, although perhaps a little too unconventional for the way that they sort of the structure of the story, would have been to not actually showing how they survived a plane crash or the plane crash, and then pick that up at the end with her actually sorting that out. Now, I don't know whether that would have been more frustrating for people who are expecting something different, but if that was if that would have perhaps created more of a tension between her, I don't know. I mean, it didn't bother me. I was kind of happy with that. I mean, there were different ways I was thinking that we were going to play it, more conventional ways. And that kind of fitted a little bit with the old sort of McCoy era as well, and I don't know, it kind of fitted with her too.
I didn't mind it. There's an interesting thread on Twitter this afternoon or this morning by Eddie Robson, who's written a fair few big finishes and novels and comic strips, in which he compares it with the... in fact, he's not even comparing that. He's comparing something from Curse of the Fate of Death, but it's along the same lines. The key in Bill and Ted.
Yeah.
Which it is along similar lines to that. It's not exactly the same. But, I mean, I think it's par for the course in time travel stuff. And, I do see it as being part of something just a little bit more confident and positive and just a little more... whimsical in a good way rather than whimsical in that will whatever sort of way that we got last time around. Everything just feels a lot bigger and more confident,
but it felt sensible to me, because it felt like it was a really good cliffhanger, and it was like, how do we make a cliffhanger? Because obviously the problem with cliffhangers, and the famous one obviously is Dragonfire, it's always quite easy to do a good cliffhanger. It's very good, hard to do a good resolution.
Yeah.
And as Brian has said, for some that wasn't a great resolution. For me it was like, it had a bit of fun in it. It was played for a bit of humor between those characters. It was an interesting sort of take of how to resolve it through the use of the Doctor. And then it got it out of the way and you could move the story forward. So I liked it for that. And I think I'd agree with you that it felt quite confident by doing it that way. By sort of going, okay, we'll have something which sort of gets us out of that in a way which doesn't feel too ridiculous. Or too predictable, like the aliens taking them as well, or them suddenly having a teleport device or someone else intervening. But let's give it so it's something that's to do with them, but we obviously will use the Doctor to make it so it works and is feasible in its infeasibility, and then we'll just move the story forward.
Yeah.
I liked it, but it's interesting to hear why for like Brian it didn't work.
Now we'll come to the companion thing and the story division, if you like, in a moment. Now something Gareth and I didn't really talk about on Saturday. I should just tell you, there's a funny story about the last podcast. I was actually in the car park of IKEA in Gateshead at the Metro Centre when I recorded the last podcast with Gareth, I basically had to take the twins and my wife to a pantomime in Sunderland, because my youngest is too young for pantomimes, we kind of had time to kill. And I'd forgotten that I'd scheduled the podcast to the same time until about 3 o'clock on Friday afternoon. So that's why it happened like that. So apologies for the sound quality drops in that podcast. Now, as I was going to say, Lenny Henry is something Gareth and I didn't talk about in any particular depth. I want to start off by saying, Brian Terranova, you probably know who Lenny Henry is already.
I do, yeah.
Yeah, from the extras on Doctor Who DVDs or from other things?
From Bernard and the Genie, for one.
Oh, of course! Fantastic film.
Oh, yeah, I love that. That's like one of my favorite Christmas movies. But I know him from other places, too, and nothing immediately is coming to mind, but I know I've seen him in tons of stuff. Obviously, that Doctor Who skit that you're talking about, but...
Yeah.
Geez, what else did I see him? I've seen him in tons of things over the years, and I can't say what, but yeah, I liked him. I thought he was very good in this.
He was really good. I wasn't surprised. I was actually surprised. I know because he's for years he's been known as a comedian in the UK, and I would say perhaps his comedy hasn't been particularly good since the mid 80s. But, you know, that's only my opinion. But I do know that he's been working really hard to be a dramatic actor, and he's done really well. He had a TV show called Chef, which was kind of a comedy drama, but it was quite good, and he was good in that. He was in one of the regular BBC dramas for a while on a weekday night. His name escapes me, and he's done some Shakespeare as well. So I wasn't surprised to see him cast, but I was impressed by how good he was. James?
Yeah, I thought he was good. I thought he felt a little... less needed in the second part. Although
once you got the master running around.
Yeah. I felt his relevance, even though he was still deployed in the story to be relevant. And there's an interesting scene with his mum. It largely felt like his work had been done.
Yeah.
And I could have quite happily seen him perhaps killed in the plane. And then the story moved on. And yes, you'd obviously have to change things, but that's how much I didn't really feel he was needed by that point. But I thought he was great in both parts as an actor. And I thought his role was quite interesting. But I think it's possibly because the sort of play on the social media giant has been done quite a few times in Doctor Who and other places as well.
Yeah, yeah.
That I'm not quite sure by part two, where that starts to become in the foreground, he's really needed by that point. I almost feel that his role... in that part of the story, it could have been done by the master in two time zones. That's doable time, you know, but I just kind of felt that, we got the master at the end of part one. His role seemed to be done. The villain, we had the proper villain now. And does he escape? I can't even remember. He just.
That's what I was going to say. Like, do we think that this story is over? Obviously, these aliens, they can't have been stopped entirely, in my opinion, and they took the master with them, but obviously the master's never going to be stopped. So my thing was, Lenny Henry, I've forgotten the character's name, unfortunately, but escapes at the end. Basically, he calls for his like security team to get him an escape. And I kind of agree with you, James. Like, when he disappeared in the plane in the beginning of the first part, I thought, oh, okay, so maybe his DNA wasn't fully human, because he was basically just an avatar. He was just a face the master was using for these schemes. Then when he showed up again, it was fine. I had no issue with it. It made sense that the master is working with people that he can manipulate, as he usually does. But it didn't really seem like it was going anywhere until the moment that he escaped at the end, which made me go, he didn't get any comeuppance, so we have to be seeing him again at some point during the season.
Yeah, I think so. And I thought that the downside of him surviving for me at the end of the last episode, because I say I felt the motorbike chase felt fairly flat and a bit, you know, in terms of cinematography, there were obviously sort of very limited ways that they could do that on the budget. You know, you just kept getting these low angle shots of the bikes, which were clearly on which were being driven along, and you know, these bad gunshots out the window. And it's kind of like, okay, well, clearly he's not relevant, he's part of the master, maybe a projection or something superfluous. So that was just all part of the master's game, enjoying to get to the point where he perhaps delivers the payoff when he wants to. Perhaps he would do it on the plane, perhaps when they do it when they landed. But it didn't. It was just actually that was legitimate. And I kind of thought, oh, that's a shame, because that bit was quite weak. And if I knew that, if that was all constructed and part of his game, it wouldn't seem as bad. But no, that was all. Yeah, Lenny Henry was firing out of his car window and the shots were missing. And I don't know. Yeah.
I think the motorcycle chase probably could have worked better if it was more of a, I can't think of this, the word, but basically, you know, he's being tailgated by them from a distance, you know, like they were following from a distance, and he in the limo, if you just kept getting reaction shots where he would notice they're there, but kind of slyly smirk, like, this is perfect. This is exactly what I want. And I think that would have worked a lot better than him, you know, shooting at them, which, first of all, he's got like, he just denied everything to the doctor. And then here he goes just shooting wildly at them. And that's kind of like, that doesn't really gel with what you just tried to perceive at your party. But if they had made it be like a tailgate where they think we're on him and he doesn't know we're after him, I think that would have been better, and then they would have fallen right into the plan. Would have worked really well for me.
It just felt very 1980s in the way that you'd get the shot of them on the bike. In fact, sort of like McCoy Survival on the bike, low angle. Clearly, he's not riding a bike sort of thing. And then shot to him, he fires. We get a CG shot, a spark on their bike as they miss. But they can't do anything with the bikes. You know, if you're doing that sort of chase these days, you get lots of shots of bikes moving dynamically. You can do that. And I don't know. It just felt really staged. And yes, you're right. I hadn't thought about that. The motivation of Henry's character sort of goes out the window a bit as well when we have this role. And it wasn't needed. It didn't add any tension. It didn't even go anywhere. I think having them trail him to the plane, getting on the plane, then you've got the reveal as it is, would have worked just as well. And you've got the exoticness of the location. You don't need to do a chase. I know you're playing to the Bond genre, but you haven't got the money to do it or the time to do it well. So it just looks a bit flat. So yeah, doing the sort of spy thing and having them tailing at a distance, you've got all those, that lovely scenery that you could be using to play on that. And that would have worked just as well. But yeah, maybe again, I think there's obviously a lot of urgency in this season to show that there's a lot of action. We're going back to action and fun. And I think that's why it was there. But it did feel a bit stretched.
The pacing of the episodes, definitely. I thought on first watch, the first episode I thought was a little bit of a slower pacing, but the second time I watched it, I was like, no, this is good. This is much better than what we got last season, where I felt like everything was dry, everything was slow, and there was no danger. The series 11 felt like they would land, something would be wrong, they would fix the problem, they would move on. But there was never that escalation of something's wrong, we can't figure it out, we're in danger, we're all going to die, oh my God, wait, maybe we can save this. We saved this, now we're gone. Like, I never felt that in Series 11. And I felt that was a little bit more apparent here, which is something that I did like. And I should mention this in case we want to talk about this, but I did see Spyfall in the theater yesterday with that Q&A. Mm-hmm. From New York as well. So that's why I saw the first episode for a second time. But it was much better, in my opinion, on the second round. And saying that, I do want to put it out there that I did like the first episode the first time round. I just felt that I enjoyed it more the second time round. I do agree. I felt there was more kind of call to action, like they were trying to really amp things up a little bit. But again, with that motorcycle chase scene, I think, as well with other scenes in this, they could have gone a slightly different direction in a couple different places that would have made it work better for me anyway.
Yeah. And I think again, in that first episode, I mean, it's rare for two parters in Doctor Who, especially since from 2005, where the second part is better than the first part. For me, anyway, I preferred the second to the first, because things in the first felt like, I mean, like the issue with the car being taken control of at the beginning in the first act of the first episode, that to me felt very forced. It felt, getting them together felt a bit like with Day of the Doctor. It felt like it was padding. It was there to sort of create a moment of action rather than it to feel natural for the story, that they were suddenly picked up and then driven in this car and this car's taken over. And I don't know, it was all right, but it felt very engineered. While the second part to me felt like all the action, the moments in there felt, was far more confident and fluid. And that's always the problem with two-parters. I tend to feel with Doctor Who, 45 minutes is probably never enough. Hour, you know, two parts, it sometimes feels like they're having to add bits in there to make it work. Mm. And
The thing about the second part, I felt as well that it seemed, I mean, that confidence I already talked about, it felt, it just did what it wanted to do. And maybe the way a comic strip or a novel or a big finish might do what it wanted to do. Just like take the Doctor through time and not worry about the consequences of where the TARDIS is or where the TARDIS isn't and what the Doctor's doing there. It just took those steps and took her on that journey, which I thought was really refreshing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the first part for me also, I don't know if you talked about this with Gareth, but I felt having, and I know why they did it, they wanted to reestablish who these people were. But the problem with these people at the moment, which is perhaps something we still need to talk about, is the fact that they really do not have any agenda or any real reason to be there, almost. So exploring where they are in Sheffield again just felt pointless and unnecessary. And then having them awkwardly meet up again through this, these people coming to find them, to bring them to see them, to GCHQ, just, I don't know, it just felt,
do they need a reason to be there? I'm thinking back to classic companions who maybe just, you know, they were just there for the ride, and but obviously that's a different era and a different era of storytelling on TV. I know what you're saying, and perhaps, you know, at least one does need to have a quote reason unquote to be there. I'm just, maybe my struggle to work out what that reason could be is being echoed in what you're saying though.
I mean, to me, if you're going to do that, I don't think you need to reestablish these characters, and if you do, you probably got a problem with the characters, because for me it'd have been better to have done a sort of thing where you could have had the TARDIS pulled off course, some technology used to draw the TARDIS to Earth, they get out, there's a car waiting for them, you can then even do your car attack scene and just go from there. But this sort of awkward who these people are just doesn't work for me, because I don't think audiences really care, and you're going over grounds where they do not care. They do not care about why, especially in a show where it's about time. So this whole thing about, oh, you're going off again, where are you going, you know, why are you taking so much time? You're assuming, well, because she's got so much control of TARDIS, she's just taking them back a few minutes after they leave, so why is this a problem? Why are we doing this? And it felt like it were doing it because they want to try and make these characters things. But the problem with this show still has is it's still trapped. And we've talked about this for 3 decades. You can't keep doing the same bloody companion over and over again. And they're still doing it. And it's the companion who is a contemporary person who represents, probably to some degree, represents the millennial struggle, and some Gen X struggle as well, and Zoomer struggle too, of, you know, feeling displaced, that they have more to give, their jobs aren't giving them, the life's not giving them more, along comes the Doctor, that gives them a sense of adventure and meaning, which they will find through their trips, and they will backpack across the universe, have fun, become better, more than they're allowed to be in our existence. But that doesn't take you anywhere, and it doesn't give you anything. And if you don't have anything that makes these people different, they're just doing the same journey 3 times over. And you, I don't know, think of Doctor Who, multiple Doctor Who companions in the past. You don't have this sort of dynamic. These 3 contemporary people, you know, Ryan and Yaz are almost identical in everything apart from the fact one has a job and the other really doesn't. And that's the only defining factor between the two. The dyspraxia is gone. We have one reference to it, I think, today about the bicycle. This episode, there's nothing there for them, and I think that the show is struggling with these companions, not because of the actors, who are good, they're doing what they're told and they're doing it well. Graham works the best because he does sort of have an internal agency, doesn't he? He's you know, he's coming to terms with grief, he's trying to find something new in life, in his retirement essentially, and that is something the show doesn't tend to do, so that is a little fresh. But the other two are still stuck in the Rose, Martha, Donna, Clara, all of them. It's Bill.
That's the same thing. Been my big issue this whole time, all the years. Like in 2005, it made sense. Keep bringing things home to Rose's family because it was how the audience was going to relate to life traveling with the Doctor. But then they tried to do it again with Martha, and then they did it again with Donna, and then, you know, Amy and Rory were constantly being brought home. It's like, what do you want? Do you want the adventures, or do you want your life on Earth? You know, and to me, it's boring to keep going back home. It's boring to see Yaz's family. It's boring to see, you know, Donna's family, everybody's family. It just got old. It got tiresome. I think, and I said this for a while, it would have been more interesting if when the Doctor regenerated, especially under the circumstances of given like a new regeneration cycle, and this was for Capaldi's life, to have the mind be jostled so much that they had to learn how to fly the TARDIS again. And this way, any companions that traveled with them, the struggle was, I'm going to get you back home, or maybe somewhere you belong, more so one day that you feel is a fitting place for you to leave. But they couldn't. Because if you're going to give the Doctor total control over the TARDIS and always be able to bring the companions home, then that's boring. Like, it was more interesting when they were just on the run. They didn't know where the adventures were. And maybe the internal struggle was kind of like, look, I do want to go home at some point, but we're not getting there. You know, and I think we're missing that. And as much as I like the Doctor having total control over the TARDIS, I just feel like we go to Earth too often to see characters that I don't care about, and they don't enhance the story for me in any way.
And we don't believe in their. I mean, I know we've talked about this many times before, that we have this thing where they're going out for the adventure. And even though, to be fair to season 11 and 12, they have, well, season 11 specifically, they have tried to make a big thing about the fact that it is dangerous. You come with me, you won't come back the same. And that's not always a good thing. There's still this sort of joyride, backpacking, sort of middle-class Westerner experience of going to exotic places and enjoying it, no matter what troubles that those cultures have, what poverties or wars. You know, we're just here to sightsee and perhaps help you out a bit, then we move on. It's like, where do you go with that? Where's their end goal? I mean, you look at Davison's companions, where you have a set of four. You've got one, you've got Adric, who comes from a different dimension. You've got Nissa, who comes from a different planet. You've got Tegan, who is from Earth, who wants to get home. So you've got three different agencies there to some, or different perspectives. So they'll come to a story with three different ways of dealing with it. And that is important. So you have, you know, think of Jamie. You know, Jamie would come to a contemporary Earth story, and the way he would deal with people would be different, because he wouldn't know what the hell social media is. He wouldn't know how to use a phone. And so it would mean that his character would be written away, which would be a little interesting, because he would be different. But when you've got three characters who all know what social media is, all know what a phone does, all know that they can be tracked, all know what a plane does, it's sort of you are duplicating yourself. And I think that is where the show is really struggling at the moment, and has been. I think having four characters works, but you've got to have four different characters rather than Graham, who has a bit of, as I say, a bit of character and is, you know, he's got a good act behind him. But you've got two young actors who are very good, who I think can do good stuff, but you're just not giving them the material to do it with.
Go on, I was going to say, I do think it's very telling too. Like, even if you stay strictly within the new series for this, you know, an episode that I know I love to hate, which is Love and Monsters, but you had an alien trying to track down Rose and the Doctor, and trying to track down the Doctor through Rose, essentially, but have an entire team trying to figure out where they were going to be, if they were going to land back on Earth, where they were. And despite the fact that Rose came home every 5 seconds to see her mom and Mickey and whomever, you know, they still couldn't find where she was, indicating that, you know, they were off quite often in the TARDIS and stopping back home every once in a blue moon to say hi. Versus this episode, Spyfall, the first episode, the MI6 knows exactly where the three of them are at that exact moment, like indicating that they come home that often, that they're super easy to find. And that was where the issue for me lies, is that like they seem to be living their Earth lives and occasionally go out and have an adventure with the Doctor. And then it's then at the end of the second episode, like, are we being replaced? And it's like, I mean, you aren't with her 24/7. Maybe she travels with other people when she's not traveling with you. You don't know that at this point, you know, like it didn't feel right. Like, if they were with her like 24/7 and all of a sudden she's with two new people, I can see that. But considering MI6 knew where to find you all, when one of them's playing basketball, not even at his house, like, it's like, come on. It's a little too convenient.
To me, you could keep Graham. If you took one of the historical characters from this episode, put her on board, and then put in, say, Rusty the Dalek from the Capaldi era, seriously, that is an interesting dynamic.
Yeah.
It'd be a weird dynamic, but it would be interesting. And you wouldn't even have to have Rusty in every episode. I'm sure he'd be quite happy, like chameleons, sort of stuck in the TARDIS, researching various things.
Unable to move.
Well, yeah. So, I mean, obviously, he'd be more mobile, but you could do that sort of thing. Or, okay, let's go this series. The girl at the end of the Dalek episode, you could do a 7 of 9 Voyager thing and have her part Dalek, have her part of the crew. How would she work with Graham? How would Graham relate to her? How would she relate to the Doctor? How comfortable would the Doctor be with her? Have a historical person in there and too. How does that historical person relate to Graham? How does she deal with this futuristic hybrid of Rusty or Dalek woman? You suddenly got a group of people which are interesting. And you still got someone there, Graham, who represents the bridge to Earth and contemporary society if you feel you need it. That, to me, is what the show isn't doing. And to me, that is so bloody obvious, is what the show can be doing now and what other shows have been doing for the last 20 years. Why have you not worked this out? Buffy worked out that you need Spike there to make, you know, to make it engaging. Put something odd in there. 7 of 9, as I said, for, you know, River in Firefly. Throw something into the mix which, you know, just spices up your protagonists. And they're still not doing it. And I find it befuddling. It's almost as if the show is trapped in its own traditional legacy. The Terrence Dix mantra that the companion is there just simply to answer the Doctor's questions. And they seem to not be able to escape that in the way that Big Finish has. The New Adventures did. But the show doesn't seem to be able to do that. And that's really weird.
It's interesting that you should bring up Big Finish, because I'm not sure I said this in a recent podcast. Maybe I did, but the Eighth Doctor plays, starting with Dark Eyes all the way up through the latest one, which was Ravenous, and concurrently running with the Time War series with Paul McGann. They're amazing. Amazingly written. They're exactly what I'm looking for in Doctor Who. They have the sort of time-bending stuff, like going backwards on themselves kind of thing that I love, but not in the solve a loophole the way that they did with the airplane in this story. And it's amazing to me that you can get a team of writers that are doing kind of like the B team work for a TV show like this, that can get it so right when the A team is still here kind of like struggling, trying to find what the show is supposed to be or what it can be. It has exactly what you're even saying. You've got Liv, a character from the future who is so disenchanted with life because she lived through the Dalek occupation. You know, she even watched the Doctor basically hand the Daleks victory. So she's kind of like in a very different place. And you got Helen from the 1960s who still has that wide-eyed enthusiasm kind of thing. And it's exactly what you're describing. And it's weird that they just can't translate that to TV.
Because it's not even like, I mean, I know you, like a lot of us, there's a certain complexity to Doctor Who which Big Finish can offer, which might be a little too much for some audiences, you know, because we've obviously got this wide audience demographic. But what you're describing there would work for any demographic. That's not something which just would fulfill the interests of fans. That's something which would engage anyone because it gives, as you say, different positions, different perspectives. And to write would be far more engaging, surely. That would give them so many more ideas and take you away from having... You could even do bottle episodes with that, couldn't you? I mean, other shows do bottle episodes. Doctor Who doesn't really do that. You could have them in the TARDIS, an Edge of Destruction thing, where the whole destruction is having four very different people who don't quite clink together. You could do a show around that.
And I would even argue that in the latest box set, Ravenous, they had a bunch of Masters together. They did their own Day of the Master kind of storyline. All of them were seen in Doctor Who. You know, obviously it was either Jeffrey Beavers or Eric Roberts were in there that maybe new viewers might not be familiar with, but you had Derek Jacobi and Michelle Gomez. That would probably be the most kind of, oh, geez, maybe Big Finish is doing something that they have a luxury that the TV show can't do because you have to worry about new viewers kind of thing. And that was basically 2 episodes out of 16 in that box set. Everything from Dark Eyes all the way up through Ravenous, minus those 2 episodes, I think they did a great job of introducing new things. For instance, in Doom Coalition and Ravenous, they introduced a new Time Lord called the Eleven. And the premise of the Eleven is that rather than regenerating into a new body like every other Time Lord does and having the memories of all his previous lives just as his previous self, you know, he knows he lived those lives kind of thing. All of his previous lives are still in his head in a kind of multiple personality disorder kind of thing. So everyone is there fighting for leadership of that body, essentially. They're all trying to rule the coup. And it's an amazing thing to sit there and go, they created a character that the TV show should have created, that anybody could have understood because it was easily explained and became the main nemesis of basically two box sets. Well, the main nemesis of one and then basically the secondary, sort of the main nemesis of the second one as well. It was huge. They didn't sit there and go, well, let's just tell, you know, the same old story with, you know, the Daleks again, or the same old story. Let's revive the Silurians, or let's go back and revive something, you know, like the Candyman, which is hilarious that I say that because they did bring back the Candyman, but it freaking worked. And you don't need to even know that the Candyman was ever used before. But the point is that they didn't go for like, you know, one trick things that only fans would know. They expanded into new, like, Paul McGann has his era set up in different ways. There's the Charlie era and then there's the Lucy era. And a lot of those things kind of fed on, let's play off of ideas from the past kind of thing like that. But then you get to Dark Eyes where they kind of realized we can do something here. We can make new series seasons. And essentially they released four box sets for every title, Dark Eyes, Doom Coalition and Ravenous. And those four box sets equate to 16 episodes. So that's about, obviously a little bit more, but that's about one new series season. It has an overarching theme for the most part, whereas, say, a box set like Ravenous decided, let's make that overarching theme be every so many episodes, but then we'll have a bunch of solo episodes in between, rather than every episode is connected to the main plot. But it's modern storytelling at its best. TV would thrive with this. I mean, this is exactly the type of storytelling that TV does now that Doctor Who is not doing. It's the type of storytelling that someone like Moffat wanted to do by having an amazing running arc through all the episodes that all us fans sat there and said, oh, I like individual adventures. But the beautiful thing about this, if you listen to these box sets, it can work in such a way that still makes those individual episodes still individual stories, but still further the running plot. Okay. And I don't know how else to describe it, but it's what's missing right now from TV Doctor Who.
Yeah. Well, let's not completely throw the trash on that, because there are signs that Chris Chibnall is trying to do something vis-a-vis the Master and Gallifrey.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think we should just sort of say that I think the stuff that has been going on in these last two episodes has been really good. It's just befuddling when you have these things like Brian is saying to do with character, which I think is upsetting because it leads to attacks on people like Jodie Whittaker as well and the actors. And it's just like, oh, you know, they're boring. They can't act, or Jodie's dull. It's like, well, I think they've got the Doctor right. I just think the rest of it needs, they've got problems there, which they're just having to patch up. But beyond that, I think there was a lot of good stuff here. And I think the Gallifrey stuff was interesting. I got confused. I thought Gallifrey was out of its bubble. I thought it was at the end of time now.
Someone made a similar reference.
Not that it
maybe on Facebook. I don't think anyone cares. Well, you know, I think obviously some people know. Casual viewer doesn't care. Just Planet of the Time Lords, isn't it? So it doesn't really matter where it is. So yeah.
my thing with all of that is we just got it back. After living through the Russell T. Davis era where it wasn't there and the Doctor was basically Superman, which I personally never liked, I think, again, and I'll just say 2 seconds of it, but I think it's something that Big Finish uses well, the Time Lords, because they really make them formidable and worthy of story usage. I think having them back in the Moff era was kind of like, great, this is perfect. They're there. The Doctor can have that heavy heart lifted and move on, and we can use them to good effect, which means you can create new adversaries or, you know, maybe have a Key to Time kind of season again or something like that, where the Time Lords step in and say, hey, you have to fix this. To erase them again and bring us right back to square one, I was sitting there going, oh God. And then to have the master say, look, we've been lied to. Our history is not what you think it is. And then there's this time child thing. And I'm like, come on. Like, I will be honest, 100%. I am not excited for this. We just got them back. You just got rid of them. Now you're going to rewrite Time Lord history. I feel like we're going right back to the Moth era again. I just don't feel confident about it. That and, nope, I had it, but it's gone. But yeah, but I don't feel confident with it.
It's what fans want, and it befuddled me because I liked the last one. Things I liked about the last season was that there was no story arc, that we could just see how they managed to do individual stories. And, you know, like as I've said before, very much like the classic era was. And yet, old fans as well as new fans wanted story arcs.
Well, maybe some of that is due to what we've already talked about with the characterization. Maybe there's a feeling like watching the show that it needs an arc because there's something missing elsewhere in the entire dynamic of the show.
I still think that's a patch job. They just need to address the proper thing is that they've not got a good character dynamics in their protagonists. They're just replicating the same thing. Yeah. Like I said, I mean, you could have stories, as we've all said, all set in the future or in space or in the TARDIS with a couple of cheap bottle ones. If you've got the right characters in there, you can do it. That's what other shows do. They will have stories set in the police station or set on the Starship Enterprise or whatever without anything else because they've got the characters to play it. But at the moment, it doesn't feel like that is the issue. That is the issue. And we hide from it by creating the story arc, as you said. But we don't know. They could be still alive. Just because Gallifrey's been wrecked doesn't mean there's other Time Lords not out there. So it might not be quite as bad.
It's not so much them being destroyed because that can always be undone, or like you said, they could be elsewhere. It's going to be the rewriting of the Doctor Who history again, which I had enough of in the Moth era. Is my thing. I kind of stop rewriting the past. Let's move forward is my thing. But I think before we run out of time, because we kind of didn't actually get there, we hinted at it. We didn't really talk about Sasha as the Master.
No.
We talked about like the reveal, but we didn't talk about how he did.
Okay. I felt initially in the end of part one, I felt there was a bit too much John Sim in it.
There was a lot of John Sim.
I agree.
Yeah. But as part two progressed, he certainly stood out on his own merits as the Master, I think. Yeah.
I agree. I felt the same way in part one. I felt there was like a lot of like OTT stuff going on the plane there, like just a little too over the top for me. But when he dialed that back, even still in that plane scene, I'm like, yeah, okay, there's the Master. I know. I like that.
Actually, I thought he was so John Sim. I thought actually he was going to take his face off and be John Sim at one point.
Oh my God. But no, part two, way, way better. And I really liked, he's got this anger in him. He's got this fire that I like you actually feel like this character has been slighted in some way and is carrying that with him rather than just being evil for evil's sake. Like he really played it like there's something that has been done to him that he's getting revenge for, and I thought that was very interesting how deeply you could see that.
Yeah, I like that. And I also liked some of the lines they gave him as well, the way that he's sort of embrace of the pleasures of being who he is rather than trying to justify it through sort of insanity or long-term vengeance. There is actually a genuine thrill he gets out of being how he is, and he doesn't need to justify that. And I thought that was a nice step away from sort of trying to make him someone who we understand, you know, are overly sympathetic to, and make him someone who is just bad, which I think is kind of fun.
Yeah,
and he played that nicely as well. But yeah, he was very John Sim, which I've got no problems with. I like the fact that there is a bit of another Master in there, and I've really grown to like John Sim's work. So, and I think he owned it in his own way as well. So it wasn't like he was copying, but certainly felt that that was the root of the Master that he was portraying.
Yeah. Do we care to speculate as to where this Master lives in the Master's timeline? Is he the post-Missy Master?
I assume so. I can't imagine they're going to put him elsewhere in there.
The Master is usually linear, isn't he? So
yeah. Very much so. I kind of like the fact they didn't go there, which is a bit classic in a sense. And again, in the way that they get rid of him as well, is a very classic era as well. sort of just, and you'll probably just come back and there'll be no explanation as to how he escaped, and that's fine. That's the tropes of the character. I think also with the fact that there's a lot of divisions within audience over Missy, and there's a lot of people angry that Missy has not been referenced and feel like she's been erased. And I don't think that's necessarily the case, because like we said before, Master has changed over occasionally without really that much explanation, you know, sort of the Bruce from the 1996 to the...
I spent 25 years frustrated over the ignoring of Bruce. So, you know, no one's dealt with that for me.
Not in the
TV. Let me tell you. You should listen to some Big Finish, please. Because I was going to say, similarly, like, when you were talking about how you liked how Sasha's character basically owned that killing was fun and things like that, like, he is evil for evil's sake, but he does have this grudge on his shoulder. You guys have to listen to Derek Jacobi's work in Big Finish. It is absolutely amazing. I don't know how else to describe it. It is, you know, he's easily become my favorite master, which is insane when, you know, you say that about someone who's not the original, but it's incredible what they're doing over there. But I agree. I like it here. I like the fact that they did not hint at how he survived, how he came back, where he's kind of at in his timeline, because that's what they did with the Master virtually all the time. Like, we don't know, you know, how Derek Jacobi got to where he was in Utopia. I mean, Big Finish kind of gives you that, I'll admit, but we didn't know that in the show. You know, we didn't know where John Sim was all that time before he showed up. And we already got our answer as to what happened to Missy in that final confrontation between the two masters in the Peter Capaldi era. You know, we already did have that answer. We don't need it again, kind of thing.
But this
we were left with the whole she shouldn't be able to regenerate, but the Master has always been in situations where he shouldn't be able to survive.
But this is the point, isn't it? Is that it's good to be able to use continuity to your benefit, but you shouldn't be chained to it. Because to have any of exposition about that was just not needed in this story. So don't do it. You don't need to do it. And if you, as Brian says, if this gets explained in a Big Finish play, that's wonderful, because it means you can go and seek that out if you are interested. And that in itself becomes an interesting story, I'm sure. But it's not necessary for this episode. And I think those are good judgment calls.
Absolutely. Okay. And it made it all the better for it, too. You know, like, you weren't sitting there dwelling on, well, we do have to explain why and how he's back now. No, you just get on with the story. As a matter of fact, one of my favorite things in it was how the Master waited 70 years on Earth to come see the fruition of his plan, rather than sit there and kind of like do more evil things, or make sure that, you know, he tried to stop the things that had happened before, or put in fail safes the way the Doctor did. Because I honestly thought when the Doctor landed in the past, rather than try and use timey ways, I'm like, I wonder if they're just going to have her live through this all. And that's she put all the stuff on the plane to save her friends, kind of thing. Because then I was like, at least that makes sense. She would have had like 70 years to sit there and go, geez, I have to do something, you know. Instead, they made the Master do it. And I thought, it's great, because for the Master to do it, it's that kind of insanity, you know, that he'll just go, fine, I'll wait, I've got this, rather than the Doctor's like got this sense of urgency, I have to get back to them now. And I felt like it was a little bit more fitting that it was the Master who waited.
But it also goes,
that refers back to the curse of fate or death as well.
Yeah, true.
But it also goes back to the conversations that me and Christian had over Capaldi. I'm not sure whether we were still doing podcasts when you were there, Brian. With the idea, you know, with that last season of Capaldi, where you have the time of him spending on Earth, and you think, is this in a way a sort of understanding that you've now got a franchise, and it's nice to leave holes. So, I mean, you could have a story that Sasha could do for Big Finish in the future, set in that 70 years, where he is doing something diabolical as a sort of side scheme to keep himself interested. You're keeping the stories open, the world open enough. And again, having Jodie sometimes not having the companions there gives space again for the ancillary products to be able to do interesting stories, that you're not hemming everything in, which I think is kind of cool. And at the same time, I think going back to what we were just saying, what Brian was saying, which I think is an interesting point, about the issue of sort of rewriting Doctor Who history, maybe with You Have Been Lied To. Do you therefore create problems for all the the other Doctor Who projects, and you therefore start instilling a hierarchy which doesn't need to be there, which says the main show can do whatever the fuck it wants. The rest of the show, the rest of everything else has to sort of navigate around that show. And it kind of feels almost like, is that the right way of doing it? Should we be looking at more like a plateau, like a network of Doctor Who, which is a little more sympathetic, that there is no sort of creative hierarchy where one is going to overwrite all the others? I would love, and it might be wrong, it might be something where Chris has conversations with Big Finish or to the novels and sort of says, hey, we're going to be doing this sort of thing, just let you know, and maybe you would want to feed back into this in your own work, and maybe this will open avenues for you guys. This is what we'll be doing. But I doubt that's the way it works, and I kind of wish it did, because I do feel that we're in a world now where there is so much, franchises are so spread. I mean, we only have to look at Marvel or Star Wars to see that. And maybe I wonder whether practices have changed enough to acknowledge the importance that there isn't necessarily a hierarchy, even though fans still traditionally accept that there is or want there to be. But I don't think there should be. I think there should be a little more communication and a little more interworking between these different media forms in these franchises. So they are a little more interlaced and a little
certainly
more
at this stage. Big Finish has been going 20 odd years.
Exactly. Absolutely. And I kind of wish, so it isn't about the numbers that makes you the main and the controlling force, but it's an acknowledgement that they're all part of the same network, that some people will watch The Mandalorian but not be interested in the main films. Or some people might really love Solo, but not be interested in the main films. Or some people might really like the main films, but not be interested in Solo or The Mandalorian or The Clone Wars, you know. And we need to be a little more aware that that's not how audiences work now. And I hope that productions start, because I don't think they are, not because I think they're being dicks, but I just don't think we're yet there as audiences or producers, where we're starting to see it as a plateau, like a network, but it's still like steps. You know, whatever the main Star Trek says is what the other Star Treks or the other Star Wars or the other Doctor Whos will do. And so I kind of think, it's like you say, because as Brian was saying, the Big Finish has done some incredible work over 20 years. It shouldn't be seen as a hierarchy. It should be seen as different media forms of a franchise which are accessed by different audiences and are creating material which reflects those audience demands. And there's no doubts that mainstream Doctor Who to niche Big Finish have different audiences. But does that mean that the artworks have to be considered as one being more valued than the other? I think that's a really bad situation if that's where we're at. That, as you say, stuff on David Jacoby's Big Finish stuff is considered a lesser form of art to Utopia just because one's mainstream output and one isn't. I don't like that.
No. Well, time will tell where we're going with that. We've got to wrap things up. I just want to quickly dip into Facebook and say a big thank you to Rich Goldtree, Nick Caulfield, Phil Vernon, Rob Preston, Andrew Book, Lewis, David Blaney, Gary Akers, Hamish Bell, all of whom took the time to leave their thoughts. Hamish Bell says, new Doctor Who has never seemed to perfect the art of a really good second episode in a two-part story, and particularly one that follows a crowd-pleasing first. This was no exception, but by no means the worst example. Andrew Book, too much going on, so much so that the Doctor had to save the day off screen, which kind of, in some ways. Rob Preston, after trying to write like Chibnall and failing to impress, Chibnall is trying to write like RTD and failing to impress. I don't know, maybe Ricky Gervais wrote that one. Nick Caulfield, Sacha Dhawan was great. Lenny Henry put in a good performance, but I was a little confused by his character's motivation, especially at the end. I think that's an issue. And as we suggested, maybe the way he walked off suggested that he will return. Maybe we'll get more idea of what he actually wants then. Keep your thoughts coming for the episodes. We will be back next week with a discussion of Doctor Who Series 12, Episode 3. Until then, it's goodbye from us.
This is a Beyond Casterbrus podcast. Available on iTunes, Audioboom, Stitcher.com, Player FM, and BeyondCasterbrus.com.